familiar with the London Tube map. And that's designed, does anybody know who designed it? It's an out-of-work electrical draftsman called Harry Beck, who in the 1930s realised one very simple truth, that when you were underground, it really didn't matter how you drew a map, because you honestly couldn't see where you were going. So he connects everything up according, not to scale, but for convenience of connection. Now, you can play an amusing joke if you want on usually American tourists for the sake of argument here. You can say to them, look, would you like to get the train to Embankment, I think it is, and then offer to meet them a little bit later at Temple. And then if you do that, of course, it'll take them about half an hour to do that on the tube. But in fact, the two stations are about 200 yards away from each other. But it just doesn't look like that on the map. Meanwhile, you can go off and have a nice coffee, you can lose them for ages, you're absolutely fine. But Beck saw that actually maps were very sophisticated vehicles for giving us truth, even though what you had in your hand wasn't actually truthful. And I hope you would agree with me that anyway, a map that was truthful would be a one-to-one scale map, and therefore completely useless, because it would be an exact replica of this room. I mean, a truthful map of this room would be the size of this room. It would also be 3D. And therefore completely useless as a map. If you were, for example, in the D-Day landings and recruited by MI6 to go behind enemy lines, preparing for the Americans and the British to land, and somebody sent you to a French village to draw it in preparation for those landings, you might do that, and you might be successfully parachuted in, you might have lots of escapades in getting out, and then you'd come back, and then you'd arrive in London, you'd go and see your handler, and you'd present your map, and they'd look at it and they'd say, but this is completely useless. We have no interest in what kind of trees there are, we don't need to know anything about the lie of the land, we wanted you to tell us what the size of the houses were, and who lived where. That's the map we wanted. And you might ask why at that point, and they would say, well, because the poorer housing is likely to have the communists and the socialists in them, they're likely to be more sympathetic to the invasion, therefore that's where we'll set up our communications once we've invaded. We don't really need to know where the trees are at all, that's irrelevant, we're going to bomb all them anyway. You see the point. Maps are helpful, useful, profound, but they are not truthful in the real sense of the word. And the interest I have, I suppose, in reading the signs of the times is what kind of map would you like to draw of today's world in relation to Christian faith, in relation to the gospel, and in relation to mission? And I'm figuring that most Christians, particularly most thinking Christians, have maps in their mind about what the world is like. And some of those look a little bit like medieval maps. We know where we are. We know what's around us. These outer fringes, there'd be leviathans and dragons and two-headed beasts. And over to the left, over there, is the end of the world and chaos. There are plenty of people wandering around with maps like that in their heads, even in the 21st century. Has anyone ever seen a copy of the Mappa Mundi, which is in Hereford Cathedral? A number of copies of that. It's as a map of the world, it's completely and utterly hopeless. And when you look at it, you honestly cannot figure out where you are. We've just had some new signs go up at Cuddeston today, which contain the college logo and crest on the front and on the back. A nice helpful map that says you are here. And they're accurate, really. I mean, to scale, obviously, bearing in mind one can read symbols. But if you read the Mappa Mundi and you looked at it, you really wouldn't know where you were. What do you think might be in the middle of the Mappa Mundi, bearing in mind it's English? Any ideas? The answer is Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the centre of the world, it's what it says in Revelation, so that's what you put in the centre of the map. It's a theological map. So England is actually to the southwest of that, and is a bit like a sort of squashed sausage that looks like it's been run over by a bus. It bears no relation to the British Isles at all. If you look to the extreme east, all you find is speculative drawings about what India and China might look like. It bears no relation to any geography at all. But it is a theological map. And of course, it's orientated in a completely different way. because north is insignificant to people drawing the map of Mundi. The only direction that matters is east. So the east is at the top. The east to remind you that where you look to, where you find God, where God will return in the form of Jesus Christ, will be eastwards. Wouldn't have occurred, of course, to the people of the Map of Mundi that that would be hopeless if you lived in Australia, where you would need to look definitely northwest. But nobody minded that when the Map of Mundi was drawn. So what do I think about maps and today? Well, I think, really, that if you start with the way things are, you end up with a fairly confusing picture of what the modern world might be about. And I happen to be very keen on helping students sometimes appreciate that the world in which we live in, at least as far as faith is concerned, is probably clearer and better than it was for our predecessors. Or, to put this another way, as time passes, we get clearer and more lucid and gain greater understanding about the world. The more you look into the past, the more you realise how confusing and contrary it was. We, of course, in our minds, tend to think it was completely different. We all tend to think that actually in the past, everybody knew right from wrong. They all knew the Lord's Prayer. Everybody knew their Bible back to front. A lot of people were acquainted with the Book of Common Prayer. It's only today that people don't know left from right, don't know anything about religion and faith and so forth. So I brought with me just a couple of extracts from some church records, which were they're taken from 1578. So these are written by church wardens in the county of Bedfordshire, which you may know is, historically speaking, a very churched county. That is to say, it has a lot of churches in it. And ever since records have begun, we've always had high indices of belief in that particular county. So it's 1578. We've just had the Reformation. And the church wardens are writing in those days, to the Archdeacon of Lincoln, in which the county and town of Bedford formed. Again, in the Reformation and just after the Reformation, more or less everything that was existed north of the Thames was in the Diocese of Lincoln, and everything that was south of the Thames was in the Diocese of Winchester, you know, historically very important, which is why you still have the Bishop of Lincoln as a visitor of some colleges here. Anyway, this is what the wardens have to say about the state of belief and churches in 1578. In Farrandyce, the Chancellor and Parsonage are in decay at the Parson's default. We've had one sermon this year. Pavenham. Our Chancellor is in decay and ready to fall down at the fault of Trinity College in Cambridge. Bledsoe. We present our Parson for cutting timber out of the Parsonage grounds. Our Chancellor's a little out of repair. In Bidnam, we present that we've had no communion once this year and our church wardens didn't make account for the previous year. In Chellington, our chancel is in decay at the vicar's fault. He has begun to mend it. Our church windows want glazing. Our vicar has two benefices, two livings. In Bedford St. Peter, there's no pulpit in the church. The Ten Commandments are not on the walls, and the chancel and the church are not paved. In what was known then as Milton Harness, but is now called Milton Ernest, this is what the wardens say. There's suspicion of whoredom between William Swingland and John Fletcher's wife. The vicar's cut down trees in the churchyard and not employed them upon the chancel or the mansion house, but has rather sold the trees and has converted the money thereof into timber more necessary for the repairing of his house, which is in decay. Do you see what he's done? He's actually just sold wood taken from the churchyard and kept it. Now, Bedford St. John. Their church is in decay and other things besides. We will reform these without any further authority from you. Item that the minister weareth not his surplice at communion. Now, you might not think that's particularly significant, but if I tell you that St. John's Bedford is the church that John Bunyan was baptised in, and that John Bunyan, the writer of Pilgrim's Progress, later turned on as being too woolly and liberal, even though it was ultra-reform evangelical, even in the 1570s, still wasn't Protestant and Puritan enough for John Bunyan. That's what he has to say, the wardens have to say about Bedford St John. So, in this church, the minister's not wearing any liturgical garments at all, and they're just writing to the archdeacon saying, if we've got any problem, we're just going to get on with sorting this out ourselves. We're not accepting any authority from you. So how long has that been going on in that church for? About 500-600 years, I would say. Something like that. It's exactly how they'd write to the archdeacon now. The minister doesn't wear any garments of any kind. Other than ordinary ones. That would be strange, wouldn't it? They just get on and do their own thing. In Coppell, Alist Church is with child by Nicholas Gaunt. The vicar, Mr. Rosen, is not resident. Doesn't say if these things are connected or not, but there we are. Now, in Woodhill, John Phelp of Harold, who's the vicar, does not keep the parish church on the Sabbath day, but goes commonly from town to town and sells meat on Sundays. So he's got another job. He's a butcher. And he's selling meat on Sundays, but he's not about his business, doing various things for the church. In Barton, though certain controversies between the parson and his parishioners, certain people have not received these past years. John Prior the Elder, Thomas Price the Elder, Nicholas Denton, just gives a long list of these people. We item that our parson withhold from the parish a bushel of malt and a peck of wheat due by custom to us at Hocktide, a bushel of wheat and a bottle and a bushel of malt due by custom at Whitsuntide, an item that we've had no homilies read, and that we've had no other sermons other than the ones he maketh up himself. Now, again, just so you're clear about this, the homilies were written by Thomas Cranmer in the first editions, really, of the Book on Prayer. So anybody could read a homily. They were all written and published. So if you'd got yourself into a TARDIS and you went back into 1578, you could have just gone to your parish church, the liturgy would have been the same, and the homily would have been the same. They were all approved by the Crown. And the complaint here is that somebody's making up their own sermons. They're writing them themselves. That's just appalling. And not only that, he's also keeping that money that's due to the poor. In Tilsworth, we've had one sermon since Michaelmas Day. In Carrington, John Roberts serves our vicar and we don't know whether he's licensed or not to do so. Again, how would you know? The dog collar, which we would all recognise clergy by now, generally speaking, is a late addition into ecclesiastical couture. First dog collar in this country worn probably not till about 1828. They just didn't exist before then in this country. Clophill. We present William Spelling on the 23rd of March, being then called Palm Sunday, in the church and time of evening prayer, before such maids as had then received communion, did in their seat lie upon his back very unreverently until the end of the first lesson. Now, this is an interesting entry, isn't it? Because you've got to get your head round this, because there's a number of things going on here that will be unfamiliar to you. So it's the church and time of evening prayer. They're receiving communion later. It's Palm Sunday. But then you have to do a little bit of mental imagination here. What does it mean to lie upon your back very unreverently? What does that actually look like in a seat or a pew that women are about to sit in, young women are about to sit in? What does that conjure up for you? That is what is being described here. I mean, I just don't know. Okay. And he goes on to say, at other times he seems to forget to yield due reverence in the time of divine service. In Colmsworth, last entry here, we've had no service on the weekdays, not from May Day last till September. No service on St. Peter's Eve, nor St. Bartholomew's Eve, nor Michaelmas Day and night. And we've had four children christened in four different ways. And he, that's the person claiming to be ordained, would not let the parish see his license, and likewise his friend Brian Haywood did in the like case. So again, you have to imagine what's been going on in this village. This is Colmworth, it's not a big village even today. maybe about 500 or 600 people, something like that. They haven't had any services for a very long time. Somebody literally walks into town, a bit like a kind of sheriff walking into town or something like that, and they say, well, you know, we're a bit sad, we have no services, and we've got these children to baptise, christen. And he just says, oh, that's okay, I'm ordained, I'll do that for you. And after four baptisms, they think, hang on a moment, this isn't going quite right. Could we see your licence? No, he says. And he's been assisted by his friend as well. But how would you know he was ordained in 1578? He's probably not turned up in his cassock. Dog collars are not worn unless he can produce a document from his jacket pocket. He is what he says he is, until four baptisms have gone slightly pear-shaped, one assumes, or at least differently anyway. Then the entry continues. Item that William Moore does withhold certain legacies from the poor of Colmworth, which his father had given. We item that Humphrey Austin, church warden last year, will not give back the lead that is missing out of the church steeple. So if you thought that lead thefts from steeples were a modern problem, here is somebody called Humphrey Austin who's taken it himself. And they know he's got it, but he's not giving it back. Thomas Judd, William Quarrel and his wife have not received these past 12 months. The Queen's injunctions and the Bishop's injunctions have not been made these past 2 years. Neither is the catechism taught, which seems to me the least of the problems they've got. So, the problem here seems to me to be this. That this is 1578. You would think, wouldn't you, that in the Reformation period and the post-Reformation period, pretty well everybody would know what it was to believe, what the Christian faith was all about, what the priorities were. Bear in mind, we've had Catholicism, a Protestant Reformation, a Counter-Reformation, and then a return to a Protestant Reformation. People have literally been burnt to death for their faith. Intense religious rivalries. And just think about all that stuff that you get from Eamon Duffy's thesis about everybody knowing their saints. The church returns for 1578 from Bedford run to 2 volumes and nearly 800 pages. And they're marvellous. They're a riveting read. But I can promise you there are some things that are just never said in any of the entries. Nobody says, for example, you know, having the Bible in English, brilliant. Genius who thought of that. Thank goodness. Nobody writes and says that. Nobody writes and says, these new books of common prayer you've got us, they're absolutely fantastic. Really good. Love the little kind of shiny red covers, handy pocket size, simply brilliant. Nobody writes and says, they're very good, but I can't wait for Common Worship and the multi-award-winning volume set of that. Nobody does that either. Nobody writes in and says, we're missing saints. You know, give us back St. Friswide and all these others. We miss those. They only really write in and say two things, these wardens. Firstly, what are you going to do about the state of our church? And secondly, when are you going to send us a vicar? And it just seems to me to be an extraordinarily modern gripe. Because that's exactly what you'd get with archdeacons today in 2014. What are you going to do about the state of the church, and when are we going to get a vicar, and why are we sharing this vicar with so many other people in these multi-parish benefices? William Tyndale complained in 1530 that few priests could recite the Lord's Prayer or translate it into English, and when the Bishop of Gloucester tested his clergy in 1553, of 311 priests, 171 could not repeat the Ten Commandments. But that's hardly surprising, as there were no seminaries. Because what we could do now is a breakout exercise, couldn't we? And we could get you to do the Ten Commandments and in order. But that would be really unfair, I think. Did any of this matter? Well, it would seem not in some ways. As Keith Thomas notes in his book Religion and the Decline of Magic, churchgoing was like this in about 1560. I quote, members of the population jostled for pews, nudged their neighbours, hawked and spat, knitted, made coarse remarks, told jokes, fell asleep, and even let off guns.
with other behaviour including, I quote, loathsome farting, striking and scoffing speeches, which resulted in the great offence of the good and the great rejoicing of the bad. Has anybody been to a church like that recently? I haven't. But this is in an age of faith. So I'm back to maps again. And I'm wondering, in a sense, how it is that we imagine that things were so much better in the past and are so much worse in the present. And I'm wondering what it would look like to really return to the past and compare it to the present. And I'm not in any way wanting to sanitise, idolise or celebrate the present. I think there are massive, massive issues about this. But broadly speaking, it's likely that things improve over time rather than deteriorate. And that's true for religious knowledge, and it's true on the whole certainly for church governance and certainly for theological training. We didn't really do theological training in this country until the mid-19th century. I mean, we just didn't bother. The earliest seminaries we have are all in the American colonies, actually, because it was felt necessary to train clergy over there in the late 18th century in a way that we didn't bother with in this country until about the 1840s and 50s, Cuddesdon itself being one of the first theological colleges that was built in 1854, which gives you an idea of how late these developments are. So how did you get ordained in, say, I don't know, the age of Jane Austen, or even a little bit later than that? How did Mr. Collins in Pride and Prejudice come by his ordination? Well, by preferment, by who you knew, possibly by having a degree, but certainly not in theology. Theology was felt to be an unfit and superior degree in those days, and suddenly that certainly undergraduates couldn't do. So when Charles Darwin, for example, his father suggested that he was ordained when he flunked medical school, he'd only read natural sciences at Christ College, Cambridge. That's all he'd done. But that was felt to be sufficiently adequate as a quality for ordination, as long as you could affirm the 39 articles and you believed something, that was absolutely fine. And of course in those days you purchased your living, so you didn't actually have to turn up at the church that you had bought the living for. You could hire a curate like Mr. Collins to do that for you, and he would be very obliging. There's a wonderful letter on record between Bishop Blondfeld of London and a man called Mr. Perry, almost my namesake, who writes to the Bishop of London in 1830 and says that he's minded to seek ordination, and could he come and see the bishop? And the bishop writes back and says that this would be quite superfluous, completely pointless, because it's obvious, firstly, from the man's address that he's a gentleman, and secondly, from the style of his handwriting, that he's clearly fluid, and therefore the bishop proposes to see him in a month after evensong, where he will ordain him. So no selection processes, no two-year discernment process, none of this kind of stuff that you expect today. He's a gentleman, he's from the right stock, he'll be ordained. And that's that, really. And that was fine for the 1830s. Well, discuss. But it wouldn't matter today. It would matter a lot today, but anyway, there we are. So, my thesis really is this. When you start to do your history well, you start to put your sociology of contemporary religion in its place. And you'll know that after the last 30, 40, 50 years, the sociology of religion on the whole has been largely predicated on the basis that modern societies, the more modern they become, the more secular they become. And it's only really, I think, in the last 10 or 15 years that we've really begun to understand that modernity does not equal secularisation or indeed secularity. In fact, it might be the case that the more modern societies become, the only thing that happens is that people disengage, generally speaking, from institutions of which the church is a part, but all institutions, and therefore religious adherence declines. But what happens in place of that is that spirituality rockets in terms of interest. you don't believe me, just go to Waterstones and go to the section marked religion and spirituality, and the shelves are groaning with books on spirituality and self-help books of various types and motivational books that use biblical or other religious ideas in the way that they've been shaped and moulded. Maybe quite difficult for you to get a White Book of Common Prayer or a confirmation gift, but you won't struggle to get Winnie the Pooh and the Tao or something like that anyway. So the conditions we live in now, thinking again about maps, is, as ever, complex. If I and others are broadly speaking right that the past was not quite the great religious age that people thought it was, the present is arguably even more complex. And it's complex, I think, because we don't quite read the signs of the times especially well. So let me give you just a few vignettes here that might actually be suggestive. When I used to teach the sociology of religion in a large Russell Group university, so undergraduates aged approximately 18, 19, something like that, if they were in their first year, with about 100, maybe 125 of them, if you ask them one simple question right at the beginning of the module, how many of you would say you were religious? Almost nobody would put their hand up. Maybe 5 to 10% of the room. And usually those that did stuck their hand up like this in that kind of rather half-hearted Anglican way, or Christian Union, but not quite wanting to show the rest of the people that we're, you know, we're really committed. But they were, you know, and that was fine. If you ask the question, how many of you would say you were spiritual, it was very rare for less than 80% of the room not to raise their hands. And this, of course, was the rest of the lecture. What did people mean by spirituality? And for some people, it was a handful of tea lights that they'd bought from Teze, and some pebbles from Iona, and some evocative Enya-like whale music that they'd picked up at Glastonbury, and an incense joss stick from somewhere else. I mean, but it was other. I mean, I don't, you know, in any way wish to be deprecating about this, but for them, it clearly was something that was not about consumerism and something that was not about immediate utilitarian fulfillment. It was fundamentally about a recognition that there was another dimension to life which only these things could touch. Spirituality for other people meant that they believed in God, but they didn't trust the religious institution. So they didn't belong to anything, but they did recognise the importance and value of this otherness. In that sense, that category of people are very, very similar to lots of other people who follow and support institutions, but they don't belong to them. Trade unions would be a very good example of this. Political parties, an even better example. When push comes to shove, lots of people have voting patterns, voting behaviours, voting commitments, but they're no longer paid up members of conservative associations or Labour clubs or Liberal clubs. You would follow that. And that's actually true even in student politics these days. What used to be extremely keenly fought and contested in the 60s and certainly in the early 70s is now a highly marginal sideshow in, you know, the early years of the 21st century. I mean, what kind of person joins a political party at that kind of age? Very, very few do indeed. And even if they do, it might only be for the gripping social life that these things offer from time to time. Another thing's been going on, which again I want to put on your map if I can, which is actually something that Grace Davey, the sociologist, talks about, and also a man called Ulrich Beck. Anyone read any Ulrich Beck? He's a German sociologist, a little bit like a kind of Robert Beller in some ways, somebody who writes about patterns of behaviour and belonging and believing, and happens to believe, as I do, that it's not all going to pot in the 21st century. What's happening is it's refracting, it's contracting, it's being reframed, it's just different. And therefore it needs to be read differently, not against the past, but rather as something that's new and developing. So a story that might help illustrate this relates to, well, I'll pick a simple story about patterns of belonging. When my eldest son was, this would be about 10, 12 years ago, a Cub Scout. You know the Cub Scouts? Yeah, promises, etc. So we used to have the Cub Hut up the road from us. And I would always drive about the couple of miles up the road to pick him up. And Cubs always overran, extremely keen, our Kayla. So I arrived one evening in early April, lovely sunny evening in Sheffield, it's a rare thing. And all the parents were standing outside and they were all holding a letter from our Kayla, and they were all agitated. So about, imagine about 30 parents, you know, late 30s, early 40s, all looking a bit angsty and agitated. Anyway, the letter from our Kayla, the cub leader, said this: "Dear parent, I'm writing to you to tell you that it is St. George's Day parade at the end of the month. Please make sure that your son comes with clean kit, shiny shoes, and please note, attendance is compulsory. Yours sincerely, our Kayla." Now, you might ask yourself, well, why would parents be anxious about that? Well, I can think of a number of reasons. Firstly, in our household, finding the kit would be the issue, really. Never mind the clean kit. You know, where is that woggle, which is so elusive, isn't it? Yes, you know. Yes, right. The second thing I think we could probably all agree on is that shining shoes is a lost art to most people who were born after about 1980. I mean, what is the point? I mean, my mother, so Joe's grandmother, brought him a shoe shining kit last Christmas. And he just looked at it like it was kind of from Mars. He unzipped it, it contained a brush, a duster, a tin of black stuff, and some other things. And he just looked like, what is this for? No idea. Why would you shine shoes? I mean, when they're scuffed and dirty, you buy new ones. And you mostly buy shoes anyway that don't require cleaning. Such is life. But no, the parents weren't anxious about that. They were anxious about this curious word in the letter, compulsory. What could it possibly mean? Well, one parent turned to another and said, it doesn't mean compulsory, because our Kayla knows that Johnny always plays football on Sundays for his local team, so we are exempt. And another parent said, well, David always comes with us to see our relatives in Wigan at the weekend, so this letter does not include us. And then a third parent said, Scott, we only bring Scott because he enjoys the Cubs. And if he didn't enjoy it, we wouldn't bring him. Which seems to me to be the ultimate zeitgeist here. It's all about him. If Scott likes it, it's good for Scott, it's good for us. If Scott doesn't like it, we'll do something else. Then you have to ask yourself, well, what is the currency then of the promises that you made when you entered the Cubs? I promise on my honour that I will do my duty, D word, to God and the Queen, to help other people and to keep the Cub Scout law. So what happened to words like duty and compulsory in the early part of the 21st century? Well, I think they're quaint and they're interesting, and there's certainly interesting video opportunities when it comes to those ceremonies. But do people really understand what compulsory means? Even I, as the head of a seminary at the moment, if I actually want all the students to do something, even I find myself avoiding the C word. I've just had the parish fete at the weekend, and I wrote to all the students and I said, there is a firm expectation that every member of the community will attend. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean compulsory. I'm just nicer about it. A firm expectation. Now, why might this matter? Well, because I think when it comes to things like Eucharistic prayers, and if you think of the great Eucharistic prayer that's in the Book of Common Worship at the moment, it is our duty and our joy at all times and in all places to give you thanks and praise, Holy Father, Heavenly King, Almighty and Eternal God. But what is actually drifting through the minds of everyone who is listening to that prayer is this: It is our pleasure and option, time permitting, to give you thanks and praise. Holy Father, Heavenly King, Almighty and Eternal God, because actually there are other things going on this weekend as well. You know, like visiting relatives in Wigan, and football, and the gardening won't get done itself. And I would have come to 8 o'clock, but I overslept, and I'm not sure about this. In other words, compulsory doesn't mean what it used to mean, because we've landed in a world in which we're replete with options and possibilities. So I don't think, if I may say this sociologically, we live in a world which is more secular, but I do think we live in a world which is much more consumerist. And the consumerism isn't out there. The consumerism is in you and me and in the church and in hermeneutics and in the reading of the Bible and just about everywhere you go. Otherwise, how else can it be that people like Robert Beller and Ulrich Beck say, with the best will in the world, it is possible for everyone to have a God of their own in the 21st century in a way that it probably wasn't possible in the 19th century. That is to say, everybody can fashion an image of the divine, justify that through literature and through other social and other kinds of media, back it up and endorse it. So Catholicity, joining together, useful when it happens, but not essential anymore for faith. Because by and large, one of the difficulties that churches face today is actually reminding people that there are some things that are duties and obligations and are compulsory. So if you just think about this for a moment, I mean, it seems to me again that when the question is asked by the rich young ruler of Jesus, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus doesn't turn to that young man and say, well, what works for you? What floats your boat? He says, doesn't he? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength, and love your neighbour as yourself. Prompting the question, who is my neighbour? Which then leads us into a very dense and complicated parable about your neighbour being your enemy. Your neighbour being the person you least like, least trust, least want to actually have anything to do with, namely, in this case, the Samaritan. But of course, it's not optional on the lips of Jesus. And it strikes me that the struggle today for the heart and soul of Christianity is less about making it appealing. That's easy, actually. It's very easy to make Christianity appealing. It's what do you do with the difficult bits, which are demanding and about discipleship and will actually put people off. What do you do with that stuff in the Gospels, which by and large is going to turn as many people away as it attracts? Take up your cross, follow. That's actually not going to be massively appealing in a consumerist world. It's likely to be seen as burdensome and tiresome, and possibly worse. Now, why might any of this matter? Well, I happen to think that one of the things that's going on at the moment when we think about churches is that if you actually return to the past, you realise that actually in the present we might be doing just a little bit better than we have hitherto thought. And it's really all to do with re-engaging with those first Christian communities and realising just how radical they were sociologically, ethnically, spiritually and religiously. If you could get a TARDIS and you could go back into, say, I don't know, let's pick Corinth as an example. Corinth in 50 AD. Let's just imagine for the purposes of this exercise that Kelly here is an absolutely ace Eastern Mediterranean brush salesperson. Okay, that's for the purpose of this exercise. You could do that, I think. Yeah. And she's got a big area, and she just goes from port to port, and she's absolutely brilliant at selling brushes. And you need brushes, it's a dusty part of the world. So, you know, good custom, good commission, and so forth. And you fetch up in Corinth one evening, and somebody says, you know, just minding your own business in a cafe, having a latte. Well, actually, you wouldn't have coffee, would you, in those days? Anyway, well, you're having whatever those Corinthians drank in their cafes. Mm. And somebody comes up and says, would you like to come to the assembly tonight? Now, assemblies for cities in those days were a little bit like parish councils in this country now. I'm chair of parish council in my local community. It's a bit like being a mayor of a town, really. That's what it's like. So you look after the heights of the hedges, the street lighting, they're all in my brief. I look after the roads, the potholes, the complaints about the pavements, people parking on verges. It goes on and on and on, really. You can see how fun-filled my life is, can't you, really? And in those days, of course, assemblies looked after all these things. They were also responsible for security, and they were city-states, of course, so they looked after people who lived in the immediate environments of those cities. And the only thing you did with your cities at night was you locked the gates for security and so forth. So an assembly looked after all of that. Now, you'd be surprised, Kelly, to get an invitation to the assembly, because everybody knows that assemblies are for men only. They're the only people who can govern cities, certainly in the first century. Anyway, you're enchanted by this lovely invitation, and you pop along and you go to this assembly, and the first thing that is striking for you is that there are other women there. And you think, well, this is a bit odd, but, you know, these Corinthians, they're very strange. I've heard rumours of somebody called Paul writing about them. They're a bit odd, these Corinthians, you know, they've got odd ways. And then you look around and you think, my goodness, there's children as well. Is there no creche? But no, the children seem to be running fairly free. And they're around. And then you notice that there are people of different skin colours. And you think, well, I know Corinth is very ethnically diverse, but surely it's only for Corinthians. And then last but not least, you see people wandering around with tattoos, indicating to you very clearly that this is an unusual assembly, because the tattoo is the sign of a slave. Several tattoos means you've been bought, sold, and resold several times. The tattoos would be on the face, the forehead, the hands, and the arms. Distinctive marks placed on human bodies by their owners and then crossed out by their new owners. Very common for people to be sold several times during their life. Where are you? You're in church. Neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, black or white, all are one in Jesus Christ. Old and young as well. It's a radical gathering, and the word ecclesia comes from that. It's our assembly, our church, perfectly secular term, but the early Christians used it to describe their gathering. Now, when you're all done with this and they've given you some bread and wine, you return, of course, to your zone of the city. Let's say, for argument's sake, that you are a Roman. So you go back to the Roman part of the city. The nice thing about the Roman part of the city is, firstly, they trade in Roman money. You've got some of that because you haven't bothered with any Corinthian money. The Bureau de Change was shut when you arrived anyway, and nobody wants Corinthian money anyway. It's not worth anything. But Roman money is good, and you can eat Roman food, and you can talk in Latin, and you can worship Roman gods. And all of that in a couple of streets within Corinth. Now, those streets, those zones in Corinth, like in any other city, even today actually, were called paroikia. And they were the zones in any city where people could go to eat their own food, talk their own language, trade in their own trade, hang out with their own people, meet people who shared the same ethnicity or nationality. So, Greek Quarter, Latin Quarter, French Quarter, there are cities in the world today that still have those. Go to Shanghai. It has a French quarter in it from when the French were there. Even after the Cultural Revolution of Mao, there's still a French quarter with distinctive French architecture in Shanghai. And of course, Jewish ghettos. What were they other than distinctive places where you hung out together? The paroikia is where we get the English word parish from. And therefore, a parish church is a radical idea for what Christianity might be in the 21st century. The only club that exists for non-members is what William Temple coined it as. But another way of saying it is it's the inside place for the outsider. That is to say, people in the parroikia, the Roman parroikia, they've got no voting rights in Corinth. So Paul appeals for Roman law when he is arrested, because he can do that and be tried under Roman law as long as he gets back there. He doesn't want to be tried under anybody else's law. But this, of course, means, crucially, that the idea of a parish church is that it welcomes everybody and enfranchises everybody, even though they may be aliens and strangers to one another. Why does that matter? Because I think these days churches are probably more radical gatherings than ever before. They're full of the young and the old. They're full of the very sane and the slightly unhinged. They're full of lovely people, but they're full of people who smell a bit. They're full of people who don't fit in anywhere else. They're full of people who are lost. They're full of people who are searching for something. They are, in other words, quite extraordinary for the range of people that they attract. And it doesn't really matter what kind of church it is, whether it's liberal, whether it's Catholic, conservative, or evangelical. You sample a church, and you sample a range of human life these days that you will rarely find in any other association. And that seems to me to be a powerful thing to be offering back to the 21st century today. This is a place where you can belong with few, if any, conditions, and be made welcome, have your hand shaken, be given a cup of tea and a biscuit. These may sound like innocent, humble things, but in our world today, I suspect they really, really matter, and they are visible, tangible, deliberate signs of the kingdom of God and the kind of welcome that Jesus wanted us to extend to neighbours, friends, and indeed enemies. So I think that's all I want to say about that. And I just want to end finally by reminding you of a quote from a just Dutch missiologist called Herbert Kramer. He says that the church has always lived in crisis is not the problem. That the church forgets that it's always lived in crisis, that's the problem. And if we could just remember that it's always been difficult for 2,000 years, we would have a better perspective and a better map of today. Thanks very much. I hope I didn't waffle on too much, but there we are. I'm happy to take questions and...
Yeah, great.
Ken. Question. What do you think the role of language is? Vocabulary, especially when we are trying to engage in a late modern mood, late modern context, where language is often seen more as a hindrance than an asset.
Yeah.
How do we, as the church, address that issue? How do we build that bridge? Because language is so important to how we communicate the gospel.
Yeah. That's really helpful, thank you. I think there may be two things going on here. I think there may be one thing to do with clarity, simplicity, and relevance, which is really important, I think, for communicating the gospel. That's one thing. So I'm, you know, personally, despite being critical of, I'm basically in favour of things like Alpha and other initiatives like that, even though I've got queries about that. But broadly speaking, I think they're very good. But then, as you might expect me to say, I think I also want to say I'm not sure it matters hugely that people actually understand what's being said and what's going on. Because I think the mystery of God sometimes may move people simply by being mystery. So, you know, sometimes I think the King James Version of the Bible and the Book of Common Prayer, it's not essential, it seems to me, that everybody understands every single word that is being chanted in the Psalms or in a canticle. It's the beauty of that that lifts the soul and causes people to have transcendent moments in a way that other art sometimes just doesn't. So, and I think, you know, the evidence for that, I think, being moving and life-changing is all around us in this city. I mean, there are lots of people who actually have profound epiphanies at Choral Evensong and in other spheres, which they wouldn't have if things were simply sat down and explained to them simply and clearly. They're, in other words, moved by something else. My theological justification for that, I think, is broadly speaking to do with the incarnation, that God speaks to us through all our senses. It's not just through the ears, but it's through the eyes. It's through the felt environment of places. So we may get very moved by a painting or by architecture, or sometimes it's by the scent of salvation, by incense. All these things very often combining, actually, to make people realise that there is something completely other than what they were stretching for, which comes about in different ways. So it's both of those things. I mean, I don't think one trounces the other. I think it's really actually having the courage to say there are many media through which God will speak to us, and they all have a validity and a value. And to assume that the old ways, as it were, which are now no longer understood, must be consigned to the past, is simply to make a mistake about the value of that past, and is to overestimate the value of comprehending things in the present in simplicity and in contemporary language. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that's very helpful, thank you.
So, yeah. And this is why I think cathedrals are doing very well at the moment, generally speaking, for education, mission and discipleship in a way that quite a lot of parish churches are struggling with, because cathedrals still have a huge sense of presence and mystery about them.
Yeah, I find this tension between transcendence and immanence really palpable in the current context.
Yeah,
and it's interesting, you know, is it a pendulum, or is it a lacuna that we have to fill, or, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon, and I'm not sure what the answer is. I was just curious.
I'm not sure what the answer is at all, but I think, you know, as practitioners, as I guess many of us are, and I think what's required of ours is deftness and wisdom, and the capacity to be able to use these things or see them used, for the greater extension of the kingdom, because they do all work, really. I mean, we have, you know, at Cudston, you know, a lot of the worship is basically very straightforward and simple and very easy to comprehend. But if you came on a Monday night, generally speaking, most of our alternative services appear to involve tea lights and pebbles. I don't know what the Church of England did before tea lights, but presumably we did something. But it seems to me that simplicity around illumination and something to hold is doing something quite important about people's sense of the tactile and being able to hold something in a way that maybe a lot of society can't do that at the moment. Some ideas.
In relation to what he was just asking, and you just said a response, so I remember Kierkegaard did Agreement. That's a book, quite a big book. Basically, he was saying that, yes, a piece of art could give people transcendental experience.
Yeah.
But they still require kind of a basic knowledge about Jesus Christ in order to have salvation. I don't know basically he said that if everything else, or all the Bible, all gone missing, but only one note said there was a Jewish man was born, and so on, a basic story that will do.
Yep.
What do you think of that?
A lot of sympathy for Kierkegaard's view, and I think, again, it's quite dangerous, isn't it, for any Christian to say at any point, I've arrived, you know, I now have the knowledge that's necessary. I mean, I'm not any kind of pedant, but You know, if I'm asked the question, when was I converted, I think I'm always minded to say, well, it's a bit of an ongoing process with me, really. I don't like to speak about it as being something in the past. So I'm reluctant to say there's a date. I like to talk about it being something that's constantly happening. And therefore, I think because God can't be contained, won't be contained, is omnipresent and is clearly wanting to communicate through all our senses and through all media, it's perfectly possible, I think, that people will find their way to God and to a knowledge of Jesus Christ, whatever that means, through art and music. And that does lead sometimes to some odd conclusions. I mean, Karl Barth, one of the great Reformed German theologians, I mean, couldn't conceive of heaven without Mozart, who's, you know, not noted for his Christian credentials, it seems to me. But there is something absolutely exquisitely beautiful and spiritual and religious going on in Mozart's music. I just defy anybody not to have their soul lifted and connected to God through some of that. The fact that he himself was a fallible individual is a matter for the mercy of God rather than anything else. And I think there's a great deal of that sometimes going on, isn't there, really? I mean, I do think sometimes that the times in which we now live, if I'm again right about these maps, not secular, not secularization, but largely consumerism. So that's a struggle for us. So what are Christians to do with that? Well, there are groups of Christians around who just say, well, we need to engage with the consumerism, so multi-choice options for Christianity, as many as you can do, lots of pragmatism and so forth. I'm less sure about that. I really think that actually the task is to be as distinctively Christian as possible, even if that risks being less attractive in the 21st century. Because I think the great lesson, in fact, of the Old Testament is that God was not looking for success, he was looking for faithfulness. And so I sometimes say to my students, you know, if you want to summarize the Old Testament in a word, it's wait. You have to wait for God's time. And, you know, we always want to get out of the 40 years in the wilderness as early as we can. We always want to get out of the exile in Babylon as early as we can. And every single time people complain about the length of time it's taking to be reformed and to purge and so forth, the lesson from the prophets is constantly coming back and saying, look, we need more time, because to be the people God wants us to be, we're going to be less, not more. And that's how we make a difference to the world. You know, it doesn't pay the bills, I know, and it's not helpful to the rest of the church sometimes to speak about that. But it is, I think, really important to be as faithful as possible, more than anything else. Yes, do, Anna.
I had a different question.
Go on. Yeah.
If the church community had a better understanding of the fact that, as you say, it's always been difficult, it's always been in crisis, what would that change? What would that look like? Would it just be comforting, or would that help us do our job better?
Well, I think it would initially be comforting, but I think all it does is just recalibrates what the agenda is, because then you then have to really face what it means to be a Christian in the 21st century, when we're just besieged by consumerism on every side. And say it's not out there, it's actually in the church. You know, multi-choice options are you know, just very prevalent, really. The challenge, I think, would be twofold. One, it would be to see, well, what does a recovery of Catholicity look like for the church? By Catholicity here, I don't mean Roman Catholicism. I mean, what does it mean to collectively believe and act as a group of Christians who are prepared to put their differences aside and accept that some of those differences are directly the result of personal choices rather than, if you like, perhaps eternal ones. So that would be one thing. The other thing, I think, would be to recognize that consumerism itself may need challenging, but actually it is not the liberator it purports to be. Most people assume it is. You know, it's an enormous sort of, you know, as much choice in the world as you could possibly have must be good, because we must be free, right? But actually all the evidence we've got sociologically is that we can only cope with about 8 or 9 choices when it comes to anything, you know, whether it's food or clothes, and we never choose outside that. So after a while, consumerism becomes quite enslaving. This is, you know, Hayek and Adorno and others who are, you know, quite into this. Consumerism becomes something that ultimately enslaves us and keeps us captive to capitalism rather than actually let us be free at all. I've had some periods where I've gone off and studied new religious movements, and I vividly remember going to look at the Jesus Army. Come across those? They have the lovely multicoloured rainbow minibuses from time to time, and they come in. And there was a period in their time when they used to dress in army surplus battle fatigues. I don't think they do that anymore now. So they, you know, they really did look like an army. It looked a bit scary, actually. Anyway. But I remember going to visit them in Bugbrook, which was their sort of mother community in the days when Noel Stanton, who was their founder, was still alive. He died a few years ago now. And I remember meeting an Oxford graduate, a young woman, so 21, 22. And after we'd had lunch together, there were 3 of us in our group, a woman and another man. The woman was taken off to wash up with the women, and the men went off to an extemporary prayer meeting, which was largely speaking in tongues. So that was quite interesting. And then we all got together again at the end. And I remember saying to this woman, so, you know, just passing the time, chat. I said, what are you doing next weekend? She said, that's very exciting. She said, I'm going to a wedding. I said, oh, that's good. And then so the next question from me, because I'm making chat, is, come on, ladies.
Whose wedding?
Oh, whose wedding? Yes, obviously, but what are you going to wear? That's what I want to know, you know, what are you going to wear? And she said to me, she said, oh, I don't know, she said, it hasn't been chosen for me yet. I said, oh, right. How does that work? And she said, shopping is vanity, it's a waste of time. I agree with that. And she said, something appropriate will be selected for me by one of the elders. You know, one imagines here the full Laura Ashley treatment, you know, and, you know, but be that as it may. But I thought, you know, here she is, 21, 22. She's concluded that shopping is a waste of time and vanity. She's perfectly happy to be sent to a wedding or to go to a wedding of her own free choice in something that somebody else has chosen for her that's appropriately modest. She's made, I think, an interesting decision with her life. I mean, you could argue that people who join any kind of religious community opt into that, you know, by wearing habits or other gowns and this sort of thing. This is just another variant of that. So she's made, it seems to me, a very countercultural choice to back away from consumerism, even though she will engage with the wedding. I contrast that with my eldest son, who I was referring to in the Cub Scout analogy a while ago, who over breakfast one day, not long after we moved to Oxford, just turned to me one day and he said, Dad, what's your second favourite religion? Now, that, it seems to me, to be a remarkable zeitgeist question. It's absolutely bang on the money, isn't it? Because it's just packed with assumptions. Firstly, the first assumption is that I have chosen my favourite religion, which of all the branches of Christianity I could have chosen, I have chosen this obscure little English sect called Anglicanism, which happens to have a global influence. But, you know, I chose that. And then, therefore, I must have a runner-up. You know, if that didn't work out, what would my next choice be? It's quite a good question for a group, actually. And this is where, you know, when lots of kind of funny, clever answers run through your mind. I bottled it. I said Quakerism because, you know, I was tired of people talking in religion, and actually the idea of Quakerism appealed greatly, really, because it was just silence, and that would do, really. Since then, I think to myself, voodoo, I mean, how much fun could you have with plasticine and pins? I mean, just think of the chaos you could cause, really. Except it doesn't work, of course, but anyway, never mind. And on it goes, really. I asked quite a well-known former archbishop about this, who shall remain nameless, but he stroked his very long beard. Just gives it away, and he said, he said, Buddhism maybe, but don't quote me. Sorry. But it's the question that's interesting, because there's a 10, 11-year-old boy asking a question about the role of faith in the modern world, and his assumption is we can choose these things. Of course, part of it was to say, I didn't choose it, it chose me. And that's the gospel. You did not choose me, I chose you. And I chose you to do these things. Which kind of turns it all on its head and makes you realise, actually, again, this is about something compulsory, something obliging. All the things that go with vocations and discipleship. We don't do these things because we want to, let alone because we feel like them. We do them because they're right. And we do them independent of our feelings in relation to them, because they are the right thing to do. That's why we talk about commands. But that's not a very good way of engaging with the consumerist world. But perhaps we just have to swallow that and say, maybe we'll do it. Josh?
I want to follow up on what you said about how the church today tends to emulate the early church. And I wonder whether that's, or how that's affected by consciously doing that. So, I mean, maybe it's a bit of a misgiving to present the early church as it was an organic movement. It wasn't quite sure what it was doing, whereas, at least to some extent today, it seems as if we want to do anything, we have to tweet about it and post it on Facebook simultaneously as we're doing it. And I wonder whether that has an effect on actually, is it possible to emulate it? And what does it mean then for us to do things most consciously?
Can you just flesh that out a bit more for me?
So, I mean, I think it almost like that. I mean, the Facebook is probably a brilliant example, because it's no longer that we just have to do something. Like, it's no longer we collect together, but we also have to tell everyone else about it.
Yes.
And I wonder whether that has an impact on how we do it, that we always do it for the audience.
Yes.
Whereas maybe for the first century church,
They
weren't really conscious about, oh, this is going to be a new movement that's going to carry on for 2,000 years.
Yeah, that's helpful. I mean, those forms of social media and communication are really important today, and they do to a point combat loneliness and isolation and enable people to bond and gel and communicate in a way that they perhaps couldn't have done even 20 years ago. So there are some good things to celebrate in all of that. It seems to me that there's a sociological and maybe a theological difficulty, though, with investing too much in all of that, because the bonding and the togetherness that actually I think we should be seeking isn't there in those social media. Richard Sennett's great book, which I think is now out in paperback, just called Together, has a very telling illustration of this. He talks about, I think it's a friend of his daughter's, but let's call her Daphne for argument's sake, who has, I think, something like 700 or 800 friends on Facebook. Something that you and I know is actually socially impossible. And I think Sennett does the maths and says, you know, if they all post a message just once in the day to each other, I think you end up with about, I think it's something like 50,000 messages or something like that. You know, physically impossible to read and digest, let alone to respond to in real terms. And not only that, quite a lot of this is banal. I mean, I had a very brief flirtation going on to Facebook because I thought it would be quite an interesting way of engaging with my students. Boy, was I in for a surprise. I mean, I ended up with Facebook posts like, you know, Daphne's just washed her hair and she's about to go and enjoy a curry. I thought, life's really too short to find that out. Of course, I ended up finding things out about the students I think I didn't actually want to know and felt I shouldn't know in lots of ways. So actually, you know, the quality of knowing probably is best done face to face, and I think people who've tried to start internet churches have in the end found that actually there's a quality about togetherness which is really important. It's about the tactile, the holding, you know, sometimes the things we do in ministry, you know, they need touch. You know, whether that's cradling a child at baptism or holding hands at marriage or cradling somebody as they're slipping from this life into the next, or their relatives and so on. You just can't do that on social media. So, again, incarnational themes come to the fore here. But all of that social media stuff is really good for getting people connected and networked up. So some of the great campaigns, which I'm sure wouldn't have worked even 20 years ago, like Jubilee and so forth, these are all the results, and Christian Aid at the moment as well, these are all the results of people actually being able to do some very, very clever networking using these things. But in the end, you have to get people on the ground and together, which is, you know, partly what the church is, and it's partly, in a sense, what that first chapter of John's Gospel is about. I mean, that's radical stuff, isn't it? You know, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, literally, in Greek. The Word became flesh and pitched his tent amongst us. You know, he is Emmanuel, he is God with us. You know, it's the withness that's absolutely extraordinary. And the witness, of course, is what we're supposed to do in our witness. It's the witness with people. And that's what really matters. And that's why Christian presences in communities are so vital. Whether that's a neighbourhood or a prison or a hospital or a hospice or a university or a college, or in your neighbour's room when they've just lost a parent or a sibling. It's the witness that matters. And you can, that's got a far superior quality than anything that can be posted, I think, either in a letter or on Facebook. Yeah, sorry.
That was really good. I'd like to kind of link back to Josh's question, but from a different angle. So I really do, I'm a literature student of the modern period, and I'm not a student anymore, but a student in the sense of, not the institutional sense, but a scholar of, just a scholar of. But I really agree with this sense of, I didn't quite catch the beginning of the talk, but the idea of developing a map based on historical particularity, and not necessarily a sort of false nostalgia of, you know, past phases of church history. I think I guess I'd would want to footnote or annotate one of the quotations you read out, and I think this may be even something you know more about, because I'm coming in from a literary context as opposed to, you know, sense of what churches were like. I think this would agree with your general sense of what I understand to be your sense of church structures not being prior to culture, but being based on around forms, you know, of cultural practice. And thinking of the Keith Thomas that you read out, and I guess I just wanted to add in, maybe if you have, you know, further thoughts about it, just the fact that, you know, there are also social practices and material practices that are that shape the way church is done, as it were, and that in a sense it's not possible to actually to understand very qualitatively a narrative of either progress or deterioration, just because they are qualitatively different. So with that instance, I was just thinking of the fact that theatre, for instance, as well, had a similar sense of decorum and a similar difference between theatre then and theatre now. And I think just there are differences in, you know, people's sense of decorum, and also the limits, or, you know, the interface of the public and the private, what decorum is like within a public space, what the difference is between the, you know, that famous sort of proscenium arch of a theatre where you have that third wall which develops in the 19th century, and the audience on the other side, which then becomes very formal and, you know, disciplined, and this early modern sense of an inclusive community within this space where they were being addressed but included in, you know.
Definitely.
And therefore just slightly more informed. So again, the early modern stage is, you know, people spoke and, you know, ate and children cried and all of that, and we don't see that in theatre space. So I think, so I just wanted to kind of add that in, but I think that's probably something you would agree with as well, in terms of church structures not being applied to culture. I think from that perspective, I'm also thinking about the early church and the first century church, and wondering what it is that we look to, how we conceive of them. And is it that, you know, we see, so not wanting to again have a sense of, you know, false, you know, unwarranted nostalgia for that, that community, do we see, you know, God, sort of some sense of providential, particular historical particularity that created that community, or also I wondered whether there is a sense of, you know, when a movement is new, when something is new and organically arising, and there is the sense of wanting to be radical and therefore breaking with those structures which, as you know, as that kind of movement progresses through history, especially through centuries, it settles into the structures around it. And maybe something that we need almost is, in a sense, engaging with the particularities of the early church, but also in a sense with spirit, which is that sense of radical, always trying to critically engage with
That's really helpful. Yeah, I mean, I think I'd take a number of things from those observations and that question. I mean, I think the first thing is a general need for Christians to be alert to their need to be culturally literate and to be wary about consecrating current standards of behaviour as being normatively biblical or normatively truthful and correct in a way either A, that they've always been, or are only in the present and have not been in the past. So let me try and give you a couple of examples of that. I mean, it seems to me if you just take a very simple concept like modesty, where do we get our notion of modesty from? Well, most generations of Christians that have talked about modesty have assumed that they were correct and biblical. But I hope you would agree that our standards of modesty are evolving all the time. And they don't evolve in a straightforward way. You know, some things that were acceptable in the 60s are not acceptable now. Some things that are acceptable now would not have been acceptable in the 60s. It's not that there's a straight kind of line up the graph, up or down. It's a wiggly line that moves up and down all over the place. And it changes. There are lots of complex things culturally, and biblically, and in all sorts of other ways that change our readings of those things. Some things appear to change forever. I mean, you know, you're not going to meet many Christians who think slavery is acceptable anywhere. But, you know, in the 19th century, that was pretty common. You could have found lots of Christians who would have thought slavery was all right, and, you know, would have given you all the biblical arguments that slavery was okay. You know, it would take us 5 minutes to tabulate them. You know, there's plenty of them, you know, Philemon, and, you know, Jesus says nothing about slaves, he doesn't condemn it, on and on and on and on and on, and so it goes on. But when it comes to sort of standards of what I would call taste and decency, you start to enter into a kind of whole new different world, really, about actually, well, where are the lines here? You know, we don't have the same attitude to divorce now that people did even in the mid part of the 20th century. Where you could have really been a social pariah, quite independent of whether it was your fault or not. I mean, that mattered not a jot. You know, being divorced was a terrible social stigma for people to bear, and more or less resulted certainly in your banishment from Holy Communion, if not outright banishment from the church. I mean, in my lifetime, divorced women were only recently admitted to the Mothers' Union. I think the Mothers' Union lifted the ban in the early 70s. I mean, it's not that long ago. So you've got all of that. I sit as an advisor for the British Board of Film Classification. And when you bear in mind that most films are made in America, we're constantly absorbed in this 15 to 18 category and the difference that a tiny segment of film makes between them. But broadly speaking, I mean, you know, we tend to find that Americans, when they come to categorise their films, they're quite squeamish about cleavage, for example. Whereas Europeans, we don't really mind. But, you know, blood mist in violence, Americans don't mind at all, but we're quite squeamish about that. So, what is one to do with these sorts of things? How do you think about these things in Christian terms and in terms of values and so forth? So that's one area I think that would come from this. I think, you know, it's being more literate about the way in which culture forms faith and faith forms culture. And in terms of what I would term ecclesial practices and ecclesial identity, the way Christians behave and the way their institutions evolve, this becomes, you know, really important, because again, you know, what we accept as normative and therefore generally truthful, of course, itself has evolved over time. Not hugely, but it evolves over little bits and pieces of time. And there are lots of things that are going on politically and socially that make those changes. The founder of Cuddeston College, who was wasn't formally a social anthropologist, but he was a very astute observer of people and individuals. So in his diary for 1857, when he's living over the road from Cuddeston, observing these seminarians being formed, he says, "I don't understand," he says, "how it is these people, they've all got together, they're being formed for ministry." He says, "I don't understand how from no practice at all, the seminarians suddenly now walk with a peculiar step." You notice how clergy do, you know, especially in processions. It's not a march, it's a kind of sort of slightly semi-formal glide. Do you know what I mean? You know, that's how they walk, yeah? And he says, they walk with a peculiar step. He says, they wear neckerchiefs of peculiar dimensions. And he says, when you talk to them and they talk to you, he says, they hold their heads at a peculiar angle. But they do, don't they? Now, where did you learn that from? Because if you talk to young clergy particularly, you say, "How are you?" And they say, "Fine." And then they go, "How are you?" The head goes to the right by about 15 degrees. Every time. Irrespective of tradition. It's the classic empathetic right head tilt. And it takes about 10 years after ordination for that to be corrected. So you ask them a question, then they just answer you back straight. So what's going on? Where do you learn those things from? And of course they just get, you know, wired into culture. And they're symbolic and they're behavioural and so on. There's a lot of things that we do in the church that are symbolic and behavioural that we never comprehend. They're never taught, they're never spoken of. But, you know, politeness and peaceableness and generosity and graciousness would be included in those things. They're really valuable things as well. But then you get into a whole subset of values like thriftiness, which, you know, again, you're never going to hear a sermon about thriftiness, but it's there behind the counter in coffee all the time. You know, waste not, want not. Not in the Bible, but absolutely deep in the coffee ladies' heads. Every time, you know. Oh yeah, exactly, you know. And
we had a guy who used to reuse coffee filter papers.
Yeah, reuse them. That's great.
Because he saw there were still grounds in them.
Yeah, yeah.
So he'd be serving dishwater.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because you can never save too much for the kingdom, can you? No, that's right. Yeah. Just keep going. No, it's quite remarkable, isn't it? So I do quite a lot at the moment about the anthropology of Anglicanism, which, apart from anything else, is just great fun. So I'm in a village church at the moment where I live, and average Sunday attendance is about 20, something like that, maybe, you know, which is actually quite good for the village because only about 300, so it's, you know, comfortably up there, 7.5%, something like that. But with 35 pews, it does mean everyone's got a pew. And so there's never any lectures or sermons about seating etiquette. But if you just go and sit next to somebody, I mean physically next to somebody, at 9:30 on a Sunday morning, they don't say anything to you, but they look at you. And their eyes say, "Behold, can you not see the space? There is a spare pew. Why are you sitting next to me? We are not married. We are not related. I barely know you." And all of this is done through the body. This is never said. No one says, "Why didn't you go sit over there?" Because that would just be brash, wouldn't it? That would be really rude. And this has got something, I think, to do with sort of classic notions of spatiality and proxemics, which, you know, I mean, again, they're wired into different kinds of ecclesiologies. I mean, you know, a Pentecostal church service that doesn't get you slightly warm, if not a bit sweaty, is poor value for money, let's be honest. Whereas, you know, a Scottish Presbyterian church service that gets you anywhere near room temperature from freezing is getting dangerous, isn't it? And Anglicanism is at least English Anglicanism, it's like the weather, you know, in this country. You know, it's warm, sunny intervals, clouds, possible showers later, the outlook mild. You know, we do mildness with a great passion in Anglicanism. We love mildness. Mildness is good. And we promote mildness across the world in our polity and in our negotiations because we believe in mildness and the value of non-confrontation. You may know Kate Fox's great book, Watching the English, which is a bit like sort of Brunowski and Desmond Morris and all those other great anthropologists. And right towards the end of the book, she goes and does some field work to test some of her hypotheses about English people. So do you know what she does? She goes to Waterloo Station in the rush hour and she spends a week queue jumping. It's brilliant. So take a queue of 10 people and then just march to the front and buy your ticket. So what does the English queue do? Well, they turn to each other, don't they? And one says, did you see that? Yeah, I did. What was that about? I don't know. Did you see that? Yeah. Maybe she's in a rush. Yeah, but I'm in a rush. Did you see that? Yeah, it was odd, wasn't it? In other words, you know, we are, you know, in 30 seconds, we've turned this into a nice congenial seminar where we are talking about the rudeness of the person who's, of course, bought their ticket and is now on the train. It's gone. But if you tried that in Boston or New York or Sydney, the queue would speak as one. They'd say, hey, where do you think you're going? And, you know, she would have to say, well, I'm in a rush. And they'd say, well, we're all in a rush. That's the point of the queue, lady. Yeah, but I've got to catch a train. We've all got to catch a train. The queue starts here. They wouldn't take anything from that. It would be a much more forward kind of way of dealing with it. But you don't do that in this country. And how do you learn those things? Well, these things get involved in policies. Goes back to your question. They don't become consecrated necessarily, but they get imbued with religious value. And before you know it, some of the things that we think are timeless and biblical actually turn out to be a little bit less than that. They turn out to be Christian ways of doing things in our culture, which is not the same as things being timeless and biblical. And I think, you know, part of being culturally literate today is having the courage and the wisdom to see that and to ask how you might get below that and begin to do some more penetrating maps of the way we are in the world and what our discipleship looks like.
We're about out of time for this kind of question and answer, but please do feel free to stick around and chat to Dr. Percy as long as he's willing to stay with us.
I am, yeah.
Help yourself to nibbles on the plates. And so let's thank Martin.
Martin. Thank you. God bless. Good to see you. Thank you.